Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world is to come and tell you why. There's a better world is to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world is to come and don't you see?
Good evening and welcome. Once again, it's Progressive News Network. I'm your host, Rick Spezak, bringing you interesting news and the important good people who work every day to make this a better world. That's right. Tonight, we've got Anna Escamani of Orlando's Planned Parenthood and also the College Democrats. We've got Amy Ritter of Action Florida. We've got Ray Seaman, who's not only with Progress Florida, but he's also the leading light behind Awake the State. And, of course, this year it's Awake the State, Free the Vote. So I know you want to join us on March 5th for Awake the State, Free the Vote. If you don't know where the activists near you are having an Awake the State event, please check the awakethestate.org website and find out, because you want to be there to remind the legislature to free the vote. We've had enough with the shenanigans, trying to control the vote, trying to manipulate the vote, trying to limit the vote, trying to strike people from the rolls. Now's the time. Awake the State, Free the Vote. March 5th. Be there. Then we've got Christian Haas, a wonderful activist who is focused on Awake the State Pinellas, and he's done some amazing things with a group of people out there. They've actually gotten a people's budget passed. You know, enough of this stuff where the government decides what the people really want despite the fact that the polls say something completely different. Well, the good people of Pinellas County, that's in the St. Petersburg area of Florida, they actually got the county to say, wait a minute, maybe the budget that the people have in mind is a better, yes, in fact, let's do the people's budget. That is a lesson to all of us. We are our government. And then to wrap it up, we've got Mr. Flash, the producer of the medical marijuana benefit. This year it's back at Tobacco Road in Miami, and you definitely want to support that. Many of you out there believe that we should have control of our own consciousness about damn time. Many of you believe that the war on drugs is a total lie and is exacting a terrible, terrible price on Americans, not to mention enriching the prison-for-profit gang. So you want to support that. Whether you can get down to Miami for next Saturday's 15th annual medical marijuana benefit or not, you want to support it. So connect to it, make a donation, buy a ticket whether you can go or not, or buy a ticket and send it to somebody. But the medical marijuana benefit is next Saturday. Make sure you support it if you believe in owning your own consciousness. Okay, and now the news. Unfortunately, once again, as always, as too often, there's more news out of the Fukushima situation. And, you know, we cover the Fukushima news just like the media doesn't. Okay, the nuclear plant, latest news from Fukushima, they say that they found radioactive fish contaminated from the Fukushima disaster. No, not off the coast of Japan, but off the coast of California, with trailings that show that it's Fukushima radioactivity that's damaged them there. And also, the people of Fukushima who lived in that area are beginning to face the reality that they're probably not going to be able to go back to their homes in their lifetime. And also, one more bit of news. This is from Asahi Shimbun, one of the major newspapers of Japan. It seems that not one nuclear plant in Japan meets their new post-earthquake criteria. Okay, now on to the news. The number one top terrorist group in the U.S., it's the FBI. Careful study of the FBI's own data on terrorism, reported in Trevor Aronson's book, Terror Factory, finds one organization leading all others in creating terrorist plots in the U.S. It's the FBI. Imagine an incompetent bureaucrat. Now imagine a corrupt bureaucrat. Now imagine both combined. You're beginning to get the image that takes away from the FBI agent's actions recounted in this book. Imagine someone both dumb enough to be manipulated by one of those bureaucrats and then hopelessly criminal, often sociopathic, and generally at the mercy of the criminal or immigration courts. Now you're down to the level of the average FBI informant, of which we, the sacred taxpayers who should defund our own retirement, employ some 15,000 now, dramatically more than ever before, and we pay them very well. Now try to picture someone so naive, so incompetent, so desperate, so out of place, so deranged as to be manipulable by the FBI. You've heard it before. They bought the car, they bought the gun, they bought the bomb, they brought the car, they drove him around, they gave him the pictures, and then they said, oh, look, it's a terrorist! Over and over again, the procedure became so regular that the intended marks have spotted the sting being worked on them. Between 9/11 and August 2011, the U.S. government prosecuted 508 people for terrorism in the United States. 243 were targeted using an FBI informant. 158 had been caught in an FBI terrorism sting, 49 that we know of, FBI recording devices of completely unbelievable patterns of malfunctioning had encountered an agent provocateur. Many of the rest are charged with terrorism, having little or nothing to do with actual terrorism. There'll be an article. All my news feeds are posted at the averyvoice.blogspot.com. So for further details and links, check out averyvoice.blogspot.com for all the news that I read every week. Also, another interesting news story, U.S. troops have now landed in Niger, and they're setting up a drone base. Thank goodness we now have drones in Africa. On 22 February, President Obama announced that about 100 USA troops have been deployed to the West African country of Niger, where defense officials say they're setting up a drone base to spy on Al-Qaeda fighters in the Sahara. It's the latest step by the Pentagon to increase its intelligence gathering across Africa in response to what officials see as a rising threat from militant groups. In a letter to Congress, Obama says about 40 U.S. service members arrived in Niger on Wednesday, bringing the total number of troops to approximately 100. They don't mention how many mercenaries are there. And I understand that Al-Qaeda in Antarctica is being considered for another base. So if they need to defend those penguins, they'll be sending another set of U.S. troops for Al-Qaeda in Antarctica. Let's see. Another next story. Dan Rather is faintly defending WikiLeaks. So he's rather faintly defending WikiLeaks. Veteran news anchor Dan Rather gave a tentative endorsement to WikiLeaks on Huffington Post on Friday, saying the controversial data dumping group provided the country with a public service. Overall, in the main, I think WikiLeaks helped with something good because it deals with transparency. Rather told host Ahmed Shahib Aldeen, as long as governments, and they will be forevermore trying to keep their secrets, that are not national security secrets, then we should be pressing to find out more and more. He agreed that hackers could play a valuable role in investigative journalism by revealing government secrets that need not be hidden. Underground radioactive waste tanks leading to the Columbian River. No immediate deaths reported, so everything will be fine. Six underground radioactive tanks in the nation's most contaminated nuclear site are leaking, said Governor Jay Inslee. This is of Washington State. Inslee said the announcement after meeting with federal officials in Washington, D.C. last week was revealed that 177 tanks at the South Central Washington's Hanford Nuclear Reservation were leaking liquids. Inslee called the news disturbing. The tanks, which are already long past their intended 20-year lifespan, hold millions of gallons of highly reactive stew left from decades of plutonium production of nuclear weapons. The U.S. Department of Energy said that earlier the liquid levels were decreasing in one of the tanks at the site. Let's see. In the tanks that are sealed, the levels of liquid were decreasing. Sounds to me like it's leaking. And the federal government created Hanford in the 1940s as part of the top-secret Manhattan Project to build an atomic bomb. The government spends $2 billion each year on the Hanford cleanup, one-third of its entire budget for nuclear cleanup. The cleanup is expected to last for decades. Losing hope of return. Azu Wakamatsu in Japan. A cold northern wind sprinkles the first snows of the mountains surrounding this medieval city. Those who fled here after Fukushima's nuclear disaster are losing hope that they'll ever return to their old homes. The mayor of Okuma, a town near the Fukushima Daiichi plant that was hastily evacuated when a huge earthquake and tsunami crippled the reactor's cooling systems on March 11, 2011, has vowed to lead residents back home as soon as radiation levels are low enough. But the slow pace of the government's cleanup efforts, the risk of another leak in the plant's reactors, forced local officials to admit in September that it might be at least a decade before the town could be resettled. I'll come back to this news in a minute. I also want to mention that yesterday, Progressive News Network hosted a special on the 1,000th day of incarceration of Bradley Manning. We have a show on the topic, and it's a very interesting show. We've had lots of good input. We also had a report from the Bradley Manning Network, and also we had a special guest from Wales. They had done a play about Bradley Manning. It's called The Radicalization of Bradley Manning. It seemed he went to school in Wales for a while, and he experienced quite a bit of bullying there, and put up a website, and there's links to that information that we posted on our averyvoice.blogspot.com website. Also, I have the good news to report that there were Bradley Manning events in Fort Lauderdale and in Miami, as well as across the state. There'll be a long list posted in that site. And also, our friends from Miami Beach tell us that there was a very lively group there that also led in the in some chanting and signage about the drone problem. And ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, I think I am very happy to bring Miss Anna Escamani to the show. Anna, welcome.
Hello
there.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Very good. Very good. And yourself?
Very good. Just heading over to one of my many meetings tonight.
Well, I sure appreciate you. I sure appreciate you spending some time with us. Well, listen, you know, you've got so many irons in the fire. You're doing so much good work. Anna, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and tell us what you're working on right now?
Yeah, definitely. Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. I know the last time I was on this show was my first time, so I'm very excited to be back again.
And welcome back.
Thinking about, I guess, what's changed since then, I have graduated from the University of Central Florida. I graduated this past spring, but I continued on, and I'm actually a part-time graduate student now at UCF.
Congratulations.
And I'm pursuing a dual master's program in public administration and nonprofit management. And then I also work full-time at Planned Parenthood of Greater Orlando, and I'm now the external affairs manager over there. So
fantastic.
It's a busy, busy work day. But then I obviously do my classes, and I also continue to stay involved in all my other activities, including the College Democrats at UCF, the Orange County Democratic Party, and all those other avenues that you know, making great change in the community. So I'm happy to still be a part of those as well.
I guess that explains why you're not a quadruple manager, a master's degree candidate. listen, there's so many challenges right now. Hard to believe as it may seem in this year of 2013. You're plugged into what's going on in Tallahassee. What are you hearing about what kind of foolishness are they up to this time around?
Well, I think definitely one of the biggest things that I'm worried about is the current trigger bill. I know that just reared its ugly face again, and so it has a new name now, apparently, but we all know what its main purpose is, and so that is very scary, and I actually attended a local town hall meeting here in Orlando with a few of our local PTSA leaders, along with Representative Joe Saunders, and talking about the parent trigger bill is definitely one of the top issues that that a lot of parents are actually concerned about. So once we explained to parents what it was, they really did not like the concept, the idea that, you know, a school from public and instantly changed into a charter, and parents could be misled to think that's the best decision by some sort of outside source. So, I was happy to see that so many parents were against it.
For the people who don't know what parent trigger means, it's essentially a way of, while looking like they're giving parents control and input, they're actually turning this school over to a corporate entity. Is that roughly it?
Yes, you got it. And parents, I guess it's through a petition process where parents can, sign to say that, yes, I want my public school to become this. And it's just very scary because, it gives parents, a little bit more control. But the overarching issue is that, like you said, a corporation, maybe Walmart, wants to get involved with your public school system. They want to start educating children. They can berate the public, the parents of these students or the guardians of these students with mailers that are saying, terrible things about their school. And then they can just keep doing this, day after day, just kind of give out this message that your child's school is in a terrible situation, and then ask you, would you like to change it? We can fix this. And, it's very misleading to the public, and it's scary to think that you know, some of our best schools that are so historic in their communities could be converted and changed without even us having any money or any opportunity to really stop it. So it's a very scary piece of legislation, and, you know, I am definitely frustrated to kind of see it pop up again.
I was really pleased to see a story in the Palm Beach Post today that decried the fact that Jeb Bush is trying to stick his corporate education nose back in Florida's education system. And this is the same Jeb Bush who, when faced with the public outcry that we wanted smaller class size, said, that's okay. He had a nefarious plan. He had a nefarious plan to thwart the public will. Now, that's not quite the kind of guy who you want to have helping with education.
Agreed. And I think that is definitely one of the problems in Florida, that, you know, we always tend to have these third interest individuals get involved who say they know what's best, but based on their track record, like, they really don't. I mean, whether they've never been educated before or they've never been a supporter of public schools, it's always frustrating to have those individuals come out and say, oh, I have the solution, when, you know, in the past, they've never been helpful. So so I'm excited that we have, a lot of good progressive voices in Tallahassee this time around, that, teachers like Karen Castor Dental here from Central Florida, who I'm sure will make sure that their voices are heard, in these decisions. I know Joe Saunders, 4 out of 5 of his committees are education-focused, so we do have some strong voices on these issues. So we'll see what happens come March 5th.
Oh, that's great. Could you tell us what's going on with our friends at Planned Parenthood?
Yeah, no, I would love to. There's always something happening at Planned Parenthood. And obviously, I'm not sure if viewers have had a chance to do some research on this, but there are some anti-women's health care bills that have been presented in Tallahassee in committee. And so I believe there's 3 right now that are surfacing, and they're very similar to the ones we've seen before, so I won't go over them again, but they're basically, you know, reappearances of the last session. And what we're doing at Planned Parenthood, like we always do, is we host our legislative summit, which is basically our opportunity to go to Tallahassee with our supporters and advocate for our causes and our issues. And so that has been scheduled for April 8th this year, which is a Monday. And we're going to be traveling all together. I think our goal is to bring at least 200 people to Tallahassee, including, you know, staff, volunteers, our activists, our advocates, to go up to Tallahassee for one full day and not only have the chance to meet with legislators and advocate on our issues, but we also plan to have workshops and speaker series and just very unique opportunities to get people not only the experience of being in Tallahassee and advocating for these issues, but also learn, you know, what the most effective ways are to be a part of this movement. And so we're very excited to be hosting that. And if anyone is interested in attending, definitely contact your local affiliate. There's 5 affiliates in the state of Florida, so find that one that is near you and let them know you'd like to be part of this very exciting day.
Isn't it true that I know in the past they've typically had buses for people who want to ride up there?
Yeah, no, transportation is typically provided. I know it really depends on where you are. I mean, if you're in Tallahassee, which Planned Parenthood in North Florida, obviously you got it a little bit more easy. If you're coming from South Florida, they do provide transportation. You just make sure you have to sign up with them. And I do think there is a small cost for transportation, but like I said, let your local affiliate know that you're interested in going. And they're very flexible with working out the details. And I can tell you for Planned Parenthood Greater Orlando, here in Central Florida, we plan to take at least 25 to 30 people with us, and we're working to provide the cost of transportation and the cost of hotel. So definitely, you know, give us a call, shoot us an email, because, you know, we don't want to leave any person behind for this very important legislative summit.
Oh, that's excellent. I've had the good fortune to be able to go myself one time, and it's really interesting not just to go to Tallahassee and meet with the legislators under the guise of supporting human rights and women's rights, but it was a very good experience because, as you say, Planned Parenthood provided lots of training, lots of information, and a very, very worthwhile experience. If you can afford to take the time, definitely you should be checking into it. You know, Anna, one of the other things that I think is so amazing about the work that you do, you're also very involved in the College Democrats. And, you know, young Democrats are so important to the party in general and to really the direction the dialogue goes, because young people have more open minds. They have a little more time, maybe, and you know, they're doing a lot of thinking. Why don't you tell us a bit about your experience with College Democrats?
I would be thrilled to. Honestly, you know, taking off my C3 Planned Parenthood hat, the College Democrats at UCS specifically really was my gateway into this work. Before I met the College Democrats at UCF, I was involved with first the environmental movement, and then I was doing human rights in Iran, and it was on a faithful summer in 2010 when I met the College Democrats and started doing voter registration with them, and I haven't stopped since then. And I was actually their Women's Caucus chair, and then I was the vice president last year, my senior year at UCF. And my sister was the president, and then I actually also served as Women's Caucus chair for the statewide Federation of College Democrats in Florida. And so it was kind of like my way to really getting involved in local politics and realizing that, you know, we had a lot of work to do here domestically. We couldn't take that for granted and to really have our voices be heard. And, you know, through UCF, we actually registered 11,000 students to vote in 2012.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And that was even, you know, with voter suppression, and we never stopped registering voters. You know, because of the bill, I know a lot of groups, like the League of Women Voters of Florida, ceased their voter registration efforts.
That's right.
We moved forward, and we didn't stop. And so we were able to hit 11,000, which is actually the same exact number that we did in 2008. And so we were happy that, you know, the momentum didn't stop us. And, you know, we just kept going from, you know, from 2008 to 10 to 2012, and now we're getting ready for 2014. So, like you said, you know, it's a great group of lots of energy, and I've met College Democrats from across the country, and they're all very reflective, you know, of this attitude that, you know, we really are the change that we seek. And so it's a great group of students. We're actually starting a new initiative here at UCF called Project BISLO. And for those unfamiliar with Central Florida, BISLO is a community more east Orlando that's kind of been ignored, I guess you could say, by our local government, and they're very impoverished today. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those communities that, you know, I'm sure all of us can think about a community in our neighborhood that for decades has been impoverished and for decades has been ignored, and BISLO is one of those. And so a community that was once very thriving in the 20s, you know, basically when the economy went down, they had a lot of loans, and they were unincorporated as a city, and the Florida legislator put them under Orange County's purview, but Orange County wanted nothing to do with them because they didn't want to pay their loans back. And, I mean, it was just a very sad story, and these people find themselves for generations in poverty. And so we're getting involved under the title Project BISLO, which is going to be a nonpartisan exercise to get more students involved in supporting this community. And we're working with a local nonprofit called United Global Outreach, who's already doing incredible work in that community. And so, you know, even when it's not campaign season per se, we are still moving forward, and we're still trying to find ways to have an impact in our local community.
Well, you know, one of the other things that I was very, very happy to witness is at the recent LegiCamp that was put on, which is such a great event, I saw you working with some other young College Democrats, and I know one of the projects you were talking about was trying to hold the line, if not roll back, some of these incredible tuition increases, which the Republicans seem to have no problem raising the prices there.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, of course, thank you for being in that group with us. And LegiCamp was such a phenomenal experience, I think, for all individuals and all groups involved. And what we were working on, it was myself, members of the College Democrats at UCF, and members of the College Democrats at USF, University of South Florida. And we were talking about, like you said, I mean, the conversation went from, you know, just bright futures to keeping the cost of tuition down to more funding for public schools. And we eventually landed on launching an initiative to bring back the book stipend to Bright Futures. So no more cuts to Bright Futures, and also provide us with our book stipend again, which is a large area of need for students because textbooks are so expensive. And so it was a very interactive conversation and group, and we assigned our tasks, and we've been moving forward with it since that point. And it just really shows how important having these events like Veggie Camp is, or like the Legislative Summit in Planned Parenthood, because it reminds us that we're not alone in this fight, and that we do have allies who we all, you know, who think alike and want to do similar work. And so it's always inspiring, you know, to be in those events. And even though I'm 22 years old, I feel like I'm 36. And so it's good to be able to kind of realize that I'm still a college student, and, you know, I'm not that different from my fellow college students. So that always brings me back to reality, to kind of, you know, kind of illustrate to myself, you know, these issues that are still so important for everyone, including people like me. So it's very inspiring, and I'm, you know, I was thrilled to be a part of it.
Well, I hope you'll consider coming back and giving me an update on how that that coalition that came together for that discussion of returning the book stipend and the Bright Future issues and the college tuition. I think that that's tremendous. And to me, one of the ways that party activity or progressives coming together, one of the good things that comes from that is that when you set up a task and you begin working toward it, because general enthusiasm is nice, but task-oriented, target-oriented, specific tasks and achievable goals, that's what shows what this stuff is about and why it's so important. So I salute you.
Definitely. Thank you so much. And yeah, I always try, like a lot of my peers and colleagues, you know, to get results. And so this isn't a movement of just words. It really is a movement of action. And so we take that very seriously at the College Democrats and throughout many of the organizations that I'm involved with.
Well, I can't tell you. The one thing I've got to tell you, and I think it's going to make you smile, I've been working with the Democratic Party for, I would say, probably almost four decades. And when I come to party meetings and I see that when I was 50 years old, I was the youngest person there, and I heard these, you know, people, my elders would say, you know, we've got to get some young people out there, you know. What can we do? Let's hold a bingo and maybe the college kids will come out, you know. And I had to laugh. And so when I see, you know, that incredibly bright group of young people gathered at that table talking about how they can use their energy, their networking skills, their computer skills, their communication skills, and make real traction, not just for themselves, but for all the college students, for all the students in you know, primary grades too. It was absolutely thrilling. I there's just no better word for it. So I got to tell you, I thank you so much for the work that you're doing on so many levels.
Well, I mean, thank you. Well, thank you. And you bring up a really good point, because I think every local DEC has those same wishes and concerns from our young people to get involved. And you know, what I would say, honestly, is you don't need to host a bingo or host any event that you think will attract young people. I would just make the environment very welcoming. And I will make an effort to go out to college Democrat meetings, an effort to you know, go where these young people are. And I have a lot of peers who have done that, and it has been very successful. Because not every group is going to realize that you're there and is going to find you like we did here at UCF. But I would definitely encourage, you know, DEC chairs and members to create a positive environment at your meetings and make sure that when young people do come, you run up to them and engage them immediately and, you know, make sure and get them plugged in.
Well, I'll tell you, I have to tell you this. The local party chapter in Martin County, where I am based, not only have they been very welcoming, bringing some young people in, they literally brought some people who were very active in Occupy Stewart and anti-war activists. And now they are actually party members and in party leadership positions. So, you know, that I've seen that happen. I've seen it happen.
Yeah, I should also say that I'm the membership chair here at the Orange County DEC. So, you know, I think the Florida Democratic Party and our local chapters are really beginning to shift in what we've typically done in the past. And I think being more open and engaging to not only young people, but all demographics of people and all genders of people is something that we are starting to see. So it's very uplifting for sure.
Well, I would, besides wishing you every success, and you know that I think that, I also hope that you get a chance to sleep once in a while. My goodness.
Sleep is for the weak, Rick.
There's an old rock rock and roll guy named Warren Zevon who used to have a tune that went, "I'll sleep when I'm dead."
Amen.
Well, thanks so much. Is there any final thought you want to leave people? You're working on so many fronts. Is there one thing you might want to mention to our audience?
I would just say to keep moving forward. And, let's not take this off year for granted. Let's keep recruiting good candidates and watch Tallahassee and make those calls to Congress and just not get apathetic to these issues because they need our voices to be heard on them. So let's just keep moving forward.
Well, thanks again, Anna.
Thanks for having me. We'll talk soon.
Okay, you have a real good night and get some rest. My goodness.
Thanks
again.
Thanks, Rick. Take care.
Bye-bye. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I have my next guest to bring on. Welcome, Amy Ritter. How are you?
Hey, doing good. How are you doing, Rick?
Oh, fantastic. Amy, I was so impressed by your presentation at LegiCamp. I had to invite you on. Why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about the work that you're doing?
Sure. So I am the executive director of a watchdog organization called Florida Watch Action, and we have launched a pretty aggressive branding campaign against Governor Rick Scott known as the Pink Slip Rick campaign. So we've branded and defined him as Pink Slip Rick, the job-killing anti-middle-class governor. And we've been pretty much, holding accountability actions against him since he first took office. Everything from protests to, pink slipping him at donut shops to reverse robocalling him, you name it, we've done it to get back at Governor Scott for his anti-middle-class job-killing policies.
Well, one of the other things that I thought was really, really a great idea, and I'm so pleased that you were involved in it, the idea, for so many years we've heard that this legislator and that legislator has such and such a rating with the conservative group, has such and such a rating with the NRA, has such and such a rating with this and that conservative organization. And I was so pleased when I heard your rating system for the progressives in the legislature. Why don't you tell us folks a little bit about that?
Sure. So we have the Middle Class Champions Awards. And what we've done for the past two legislative sessions starting in 2011 was, going, after a session, counting all of the bills that affected the middle class. I think in 2011 we had about 12 bills, everything from, foreclosures to, deregulating environmental protections to, the budget that cut $1.3 billion from public education and took a 3% pay cut from all teachers, firefighters, and police officers. All these really horrible, bills that passed through session in 2011. We went after session and scored every legislator and basically came out with about 19 legislators that voted 100% for the middle class, which means essentially they voted against all of these bad bills. And we, presented them with the Middle Class Champions Award. So these are legislators that are not in the supermajority, that have a really hard time getting bills passed, up in Tallahassee, just given the way that the political climate is up there. And they, kind of get raked over the coals for, voting against, these special interest corporate legislation and, corporate tax giveaways and all these really horrible bills that we see passing through the session. These legislators, vote against it. They vote for us, the people, 100% of the time. So we gave them awards in 2011. We did it again last session in 2012, and now we're gearing up, on March 5th when session starts this year, we'll be, scoring all the legislators again. And what's different this year is that we're setting out an agenda before session. So the previous years we have just been, after session ends, we, look at all the bills that pass through and we, pick out which ones affect the middle class the most and then we score those. But now we're starting to be a little bit more proactive in setting out an agenda with overarching principles, like protecting quality public education and, protecting homeowners' rights and, the environment and healthcare and, helping out small businesses and not just, large corporations and, just different things that we, feel that affect the middle class. We're sending out an agenda before session to hopefully guide some of our legislators to let them know that these bills will be scored and a vote for or against, a certain bill will calculate their overall score when it comes to receiving the Middle Class Champions Award.
Oh, that's fantastic. If you can, I don't know how closely you want to hold that criteria, but if you can share that with us, I would love to share that with the audience so that they know just what kind of standards you're holding these folks to. I was wondering, can I ask you to tell us how many do we have some of those people who rated very high? Do we have some of those return this year?
Yes, we had a lot that have been consistent middle-class champions, Representative Mark Pafford and now Senator Jeff Clemens, now Senator Dwight Bullard, Senator Geraldine Thompson, Representative Mia Jones. I mean, we have a great, handful of legislators that just consistently vote with the middle class, year after year, regardless of, corporate special interests and, major donors and the culture of, unethical, almost corruption that you hear about happening up in Tallahassee. These legislators have stayed the course for the middle class and have been consistent. So we definitely want to recognize those that vote year after year, for the middle class of Floridians.
Well, many of my audience are very sophisticated when it comes to knowing the power of social media. So tell us your website so we can go and like it and support it. And I'm sure that list is visible there, and we want to get everybody to like. All those legislators have been so good and treating the middle class the way it needs to be treated. Why don't you give us that website?
Sure. That website is www.middleclasschamps.com. And we have the 2012 Middle Class Champions up there. And we will be, of course, adding on, after this year's session, we'll be adding on legislators. Hopefully we can get more. So we'll be looking forward to doing that. And, again, thank you. And, just making sure that we recognize those that, have done good to the middle class and have, protected us and helped expand, middle class families and stood up for small businesses and, stood up, to corporations and special interests, and corporate greed that we see, running rampant in Tallahassee. These legislators definitely need to be recognized. And, it's a good beacon to hold them accountable for, you've been
absolutely
a middle-class champion. Yeah, you've been a middle-class champion for 2 years, and, we have these sets of bills that are going to be coming up, and we need, if you want to continue to be a middle-class champion, that means that you will vote, either for or against these bills, which unfortunately, as we see with the current climate of the legislature, it's usually voting against the bills who's standing
right
up for the middle class.
Let me ask you, was that middleclasschamps.com or .org?
I think it's .org. It's either, I'm pretty sure it's .com, but it might be .org.
Okay, well, we'll check it out and we'll post it. Yeah. Let me ask you another thing. One of the things I like to ask my guests, and, the reason I focus on activists is because when people hear the good stories about the good work that people are doing, there's so many wonderful progressive activists out there doing good work. It really gives one, reason to hope. It gives us, power. And because so much of the rest of the news is so depressing, when we hear these good stories about how hard progressives are working, I think it gives people faith and hope to dig in again. I was wondering, can I trouble you to tell us a little bit about yourself? What made you go from being just one more consumer whose life is filled with, job and family? What compelled you to be an activist, to be involved, to work for a better world?
Sure. So I was at school. I received my bachelor's degree from the University of Florida. Go Gators. And I was studying political science, but I was focusing on international relations and foreign policy and just learning about different countries and, the economics and, trade and all these, global issues. And I wanted to do an academic internship to receive credit and kind of get some hands-on experience in politics. And so I spoke with my advisor, and he let me know, it's actually, campaign season. We have an election coming up, a city election for the city of Gainesville. And he said that there's two different options. He said, right now we have somebody that's running for, I believe it was mayor, and we have this other issue campaign. And, you know, it's an organization that is fighting to protect LGBT rights in the city charter. So actually the city of Gainesville has in their city charter, you know, you cannot discriminate against somebody based on race, gender, ethnicity, and all of the, you know, things that are constitutionally protected. But they also went and added in sexual orientation and gender identity and those protections. And then now, you know, this was in 2009, they were challenged by, you know, just right-wing conservative extremists who didn't think that people that, you know, were gay or lesbian or transgender should be protected, you know, under the law. So they tried to repeal that. So he, you know, offered these two different internships I could do. And I said, well, I'd, you know, I'd really like to do this issue campaign. You know, I think it'd be a great experience. So, you know, I did the internship, and it was a wonderful eye-opening experience. I had never had any, you know, experience working on campaigns or doing anything on such a local level. Up until then, I was, you know, focusing on this wide scale and how do you, you know, change the world and, you know, do all these grand things. And on election night, we were successful. So we protected sexual orientation, gender identity. They remained in the city charter. And I remember on election night, we were all celebrating this major victory. It was one of the highest turnouts in the city election in the last, you know, decade in the city of Gainesville. And we fought very hard for that. We had people coming up saying that, you know, if you fight for this, you know, you will let men into women's restrooms and, you know, pedophile. I mean, they were just trying to throw as much propaganda and fear into this campaign. And, you know, we were successful. And on election night, I had, you know, people coming up to me and hugging me and crying and, you know, thanking me for, you know, helping protect them and their family and their partners from discrimination. And, you know, I'm thinking, I was a lowly intern. I didn't really do much, but, you know, they were just so thankful to have somebody, you know, that you know, was on the right side and fighting for, you know, rights, basically, civil rights. And I just remember it was such a great feeling. I felt so accomplished. And, you know, I went from, you know, wanting to change the world to realizing that, I mean, you know, if you can just protect, you know, this one city, you know, and just the small population in Gainesville, Florida, you know, that it has such a big impact, and it, you know, completely changes people's lives, and it in turn changed my life. And it was just, I wanted to chase that, you know, and just keep fighting the good fight and, you know, just keep helping people and protecting them. And, you know, I loved it. I loved every moment of it. So here I am a couple years later, still keeping that fight.
Oh, good for you. For people who want to help support Florida Watch Action, is there anything, do you have, they can do donations? Is there activities they can participate in? Can they be part of email campaigns or phone campaigns? Or is
yeah,
there a way
absolutely.
To participate? Why don't you talk about that for a minute?
Sure. So we have our website. We actually have two websites, and we cross-post most things. So if you hit one, you'll get information for both. So our organization's website, FloridaWatchAction.com, and then we have our campaign, PinkSlipRick.com. And either one of those sites, you can sign up to join our email list. And what we do is when you sign up, you actually put in your zip code. So if we ever get word that Rick Scott is going to be in your area, and if you want to turn out to a protest or a rally, we'll email, you know, people within a 10-mile radius of wherever he's going to be. You know, we can engage our people that way so they can come turn out to events. And then we also have really great online campaigns that people can be a part of, things like signing Rick Scott's birthday card that we deliver to him at the Capitol. And, you know, just all different things that we can do that you can imagine. You know, we focus so much on rapid response. So when the governor comes out with something, we just want to be right there to have the response of the people and to allow people to have the voice to, you know, express how they feel about his, you know, anti-middle class job killing policies. So, you know, of course, we take donations. Right now, we're working really hard on the Awake the State rallies. This year, we're doing, you know, Free the Vote, Awake the State. So we're fighting against, you know, Rick Scott and Tallahassee politicians' voter suppression bill. So we're fighting to, you know, have real election reform that restores early voting and restores a lot of the things that Rick Scott took out and took away from the people. So that's going to be on March 5th. The first day of legislative session, and there's rallies happening across the state. So we're focusing on that as well. So, I mean, anything you name it, from writing letters to the editor to turning out to a rally or a protest to, you know, signing a petition. I mean, there's just so many different ways people can get involved in the campaign.
Let me ask you one last question. you're clearly a person that's thought a little bit about Rick Scott, as distasteful as that might be. So do you think he's come to a new understanding of the importance of federal medical dollars?
I think he's coming to an understanding of what he's going to have to do to get reelected. let's not fool ourselves. I mean, this is a governor who, you know, has done very, very harmful things to the state of Florida. He had been, up until, you know, his recent endorsement of Medicaid expansion, he had been denying Affordable Care Act funding for, I mean, we're talking about abused and neglected children. We're talking about nursing home funding. I mean, he's just been outright denying and rejecting funding for health care in Florida. And he's been opposed to expanding Medicaid this whole time. But then again, when, you know, you are trying to get reelected and you realize you have, like, one of the lowest approval ratings in the country, you know, maybe it's time that you, you know, appear to, you know, acquiesce to what the middle class is asking for. And
Amy, he's also going to give a few pennies back to teachers. Come on.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, hey, you know what? This guy will say anything, you know, to get reelected at this point. But if you look at his track record, if you look at what he's actually done, you know, it speaks volumes. And, you know, the only reason he's really accepting this Medicaid expansion is because he put in for a waiver to privatize a lot of it. So, you know, he's still pushing for the privatization of health care.
He may think he still has a chance to steal that money.
Exactly. I mean, we're talking about the guy that committed the biggest Medicare fraud in U.S. history when he was CEO of Columbia HCA, you know, healthcare company. So,
right.
You know, when it comes to moving around, you know, federal dollars for healthcare, this is the guy that knows how to commit fraud and walk away a millionaire.
Well, thank you so much, my dear. It's really a pleasure talking to you. And listen, you come back anytime, okay?
Thanks so much, Rick. I appreciate it.
Okay. Have a real good night and keep up the good work.
Thanks, you too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Well, that was Amy Ritter of Florida Watch Action. Next up, Ray Seaman from Progress Florida, who's going to tell us a little bit more about Awake the State, Free the Vote. So hold on just 1 second, and we'll pull up that little interview. Here we go. Ray Seaman, Awake the State.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Mr. Ray Seaman, who is with Progress Florida, and also I'm going to go ahead and say the leading light behind the Florida movement of Awake the State. Ray, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Ray, you've been involved for a long time. You've been a very committed activist trying to ensure that citizens understand how to participate, so that the agenda that goes on in our governments, both local and state, somehow is aligned with public needs. Why don't you talk just a little bit about how you got involved in doing political work, and then we'll go on to some of your specific targeted actions right now.
Well, yeah, there are a lot of reasons why I got politically involved, and we could probably spend all morning talking about those, just to condense it down. You know, I grew up in here where I still live, in Marion County, and Marion County, like Florida in general, is a beautiful place. It's a wonderful place to live, but we've got some problems. We've got some issues, everything from some rather very apparent income inequality to threats posed to our land and our water, you know, shortchanging of education and healthcare in favor of big tax giveaways to the wealthy and the well-connected. You know, there are a lot of different things that sort of got me involved. But I would say probably more than anything else, my experience sort of growing up here in Marion County, along with all the different events that were taking place roughly 10 years ago, sort of the aftermath of 9/11 and the run-up to Iraq. But also, once I was in college, you know, I took a pretty strong interest in state and local politics because, you know, again, my experience in Marion County, but also, you know, that's where I think a lot of us can make the most difference at this point. You know, a lot of, even though we focus a lot of time and attention on Washington, and rightly so, but a lot of the governing that takes place in our country takes place in state capitals and in county commissions and school boards. And unfortunately, I don't think those get anywhere near the level of attention and resources that, that they need to. So that's where I've spent probably the last five, six, 7 years of my life working on is state and local politics.
Ray, for my listeners who are not as geographically enlightened as others might be, could you give people an idea of where Marion County is?
Yeah, Marion County is almost, you could almost argue it's dead center in the state, if you sort of include the panhandle and sort of how you view Florida. It's roughly an hour south of Gainesville and an hour and a half north of both Orlando and Tampa. So it's kind of almost equidistant between those three areas. Yeah, so we're roughly dead center north central Florida.
Okay, well, thanks. I had the good fortune to be a participant in a group of progressives who came together, it seems so long ago, back in 2004. We looked at the exciting state of affairs with the Bush regime, both national and statewide. And we tried to come together with some common cause. And as this evolved into a larger and larger and larger group with larger activities and more resources, I also had the good fortune to see you bring to this group a thought experiment. The idea mm-hmm. that if we could come together you had this idea, and it clearly it hadn't all formed in your mind. You were sharing a thought experiment. You said, I'm thinking it's called Awake the State. My goodness, how far that has come in these few short years.
Indeed. Yeah. It's hard to believe it. It's only been a little bit more than 2 years ago. It seems only a few months ago. Really, the last couple of years have gone by so fast. But yeah, I came to LegiCamp, our first ever LegiCamp, in 2011. With the idea that we should do rallies all over the state on the opening day of legislative session to highlight and bring to light, I should say, a lot of the really extreme proposals that Governor Scott and his allies in the legislature were proposing, and really how that would really decimate the middle class in Florida if a lot of it was allowed to happen. Keep in mind, back then, Rick Scott had proposed in only roughly around a month after getting elected, and we have often forgotten this, but he was proposing at the time a universal private voucher system, literally doing away with the public education system altogether. Luckily, that was dropped pretty fast in the months that followed after folks realized, oh, yeah, there's this thing in the Florida Constitution in Article 9, which actually says that you have to have a free, uniform system of public education. but not that that's ever stopped folks like that before, but you managed to do this.
You jumped in on that one ahead of me.
indeed. Exactly, Rick. And then he just kept tripping over himself after that, just really, really overreaching in a spectacular way, rejecting high-speed rail funding and the thousands of jobs that came with that and the modern transportation infrastructure that would have more or less initiated, bringing back the really much reviled teacher merit pay bill, which they were able to pass and is still very much reviled, and now they're talking about sort of scaling that back. Privatizing Medicaid, which they may partially get done now, completely zeroing out funding for Florida Forever, which is our state's land conservation program where we buy sensitive lands and habitats. At one point in Florida, it was a model program for the world, not just for our state and the country. We had upwards of $300 million appropriated into Florida Forever at the height of the program, and Rick Scott was essentially zeroing that out after some reductions in years past. So just this really extreme anti-middle-class agenda. I was extremely concerned about it. Like everyone else, I was really depressed, of course, about the 2010 election results and who had just gotten elected. I think because of all the overreach, because of the extremism, and also keep in mind, we were striking at the exact right time as well. I think there was certainly a good amount of luck involved in the initial Awake the State effort in 2011. Because keep in mind, at the exact same time, we were pushing these rallies throughout the state. There was also the big major uprising in Wisconsin, Ohio, throughout the Midwest. We're also looking at the Arab Spring as well, or at least sort of the tail end of it. And folks were in a rallying kind of mood. We often forget that too. So I proposed this idea, was really excited, and amazed to see how many people really liked the idea. I mean, my initial, skepticism of it was that I thought folks would be like, you know, this is just such a pie in the sky concept of doing all these rallies all over the state, and we've got less than a month to go between now and the opening day of session. How on earth could we possibly pull this off?
Evidently, there was a taste for pie.
Yeah, indeed. That was, to my great surprise, that no one had that attitude at all. There may have been some who were thinking it at the time, perhaps, but it was never enunciated, and folks just jumped in with both feet. In less than a month, we had folks who were organizing rallies in some pretty far-flung places where progressives have historically had no business being, in places like McClenny and in Baker County, which is just outside Jacksonville, rural county outside Jacksonville. We've had rallies both on March 8th and since in places like Shalimar and Okaloosa County and deep red in the Panhandle. We've had rallies in Pensacola almost every single time. We've had rallies, of course, in Ocala, where I am, almost every single time we've done an Awake the State event. And we've had them in Lakeland, and we've had them in Naples and Fort Myers and a lot of places where we have not been. It's been a tremendous success so far, and we continue to evolve, to basically continue to fight to protect and restore the middle class in Florida.
Well, I understand that Awake the State is taking a different turn this time.
That's correct. Kind of, sort of different. The focus of our rallies, which this year are going to be on March 5th, which is roughly a week and a half from now, and folks can go to awakethestate.com, by the way, to, of course, check out our rallies, which this year are called Free the Vote, Awake the State, which kind of gives you a hint as to sort of where we're headed with these rallies this year. We're focused in particular on election reform this year, not because, you know, we're no longer interested in working on issues affecting the middle class, but what we saw in the last election, even though, yes, we quote-unquote won, is that, we had over 200,000 Floridians basically disenfranchised who did not vote because of the extremely long lines that were at the polls. And that was the result of Governor Scott and the legislature's bill that worked to put up all these cumbersome barriers to voting. And that was HB 1355. What we need to realize as a movement is if we don't remove a lot of those barriers, if we don't stop some of the worst of HB 1355, then it's going to be very difficult for middle-class priorities of whatever they are to actually get heard in the elections ahead, particularly 2014 when Governor Scott's up for re-election. And because it's a midterm election, and folks also need to keep this in mind, the same electorate that turned out in 2008 and 2012 is not necessarily going to be there. Historically, midterm elections are lower turnout affairs. The electorate is older and whiter and more conservative. And so it's tougher for progressive priorities to get a fair hearing. And then when you couple that on top of the cumbersome rules and regulations that Scott and his ilk have put in, it becomes much tougher for the majority of Floridians to make their voices heard. So that's the reason why we're focused on election reform this year, regardless of whether you care about education or health care or civil rights or the environment, all of which are extremely important issues, trust me. But those issues aren't going to get a fair hearing unless we get our elections right. So that's why we've got to Free the Vote and Awake the State on March 5th to begin the push for real election reform. And what do we mean by real election reform? We mean first to free early voting, that we've got to have 14 days of early voting with 12 hours each day. That's a far above and beyond the proposal by Governor Scott, which only mandates 48 hours of early voting. And that's just nowhere near enough. We've got to have 14 days, 12 hours each day, while also giving supervisors of election flexibility in terms of where they can open polling places. They're very restricted right now, and that also contributed to some of the long lines. And you'll hear supervisors of election all over the state from both parties agree with that. We also need to free our ballots. The fact of the matter is, it makes no sense to have ballots that are virtually miles long, which is what we had in this election, where we had amendments filling up entire pages of ballots, like Amendment 4, just filled with legalese that people can't understand. And that contributed to the long lines, because we had a lot of folks who went to the polls and then had to sit there for a long time to read these extremely lengthy, cumbersome amendments. So what we've got to do in order to free our ballots is to reinstitute what we had before HB 1355, which is a 75-word limit on all constitutional amendments proposed by the legislature. Now, currently, citizen initiatives that try and get on the ballot have to meet that requirement of 75 words. The legislature has just exempted themselves from that. So we need to, of course, level the playing field again and ensure we have reasonably sized ballots. So, and finally, we have to free our voters. We're currently prisoner to a 20th century voter registration system that's just not up to par in the era of Google and online databases and all of that stuff. We need to have a portable voter registration system so that people can change their address when they go vote. People should not ever have to wait in long lines to go to vote and then find out that they've been thrown off the rolls because of some ridiculous rule that a bunch of politicians have put in place. So again, we've got to free early voting, we've got to free our ballots, and then we've got to free our voters. And we're going to be pushing for all those beginning on March 5th with our Free the Vote, Awake the State rallies. And again, folks can learn more about those and sign up for a local rally near them by going to awakethestate.com.
You know, Ray, you talk about elections as if they're important to democracy.
Yes. They're kind of like the linchpin to the whole thing, yes.
but we see that our governor, in his rather finite wisdom, has turned the corner on some of these issues. He's actually, given back a day or two?
Yeah. And this is the thing I think we all need to understand. And by the way, I think most Floridians understand this, and I think we need to give them some credit here, is they know Rick Scott's trying to run for re-election. They know that all these new proposals to try and put a smidgen of money back into education after the billions he's cut, to acquiesce a little bit on Medicaid extension, to throw us a day or two back of early voting, he's trying to look moderate when he's still the same extreme Tea Party governor he's always been. And folks shouldn't fall for it. And again, I think most Floridians understand that Rick Scott's trying to get reelected. And the fact of the matter is, he doesn't deserve to get reelected.
Well, he's allowed the teachers to get a little bit of money back. Don't you think they'll be successfully bribed with this?
No, I don't think so. You know, and again, the teachers are a lot smarter than people like Rick Scott give them credit for. Almost practically every teacher I've talked to, and living in Marion County, teachers are not all Democrats. Let me tell you, we've got some pretty conservative Republican teachers too here, and they have also told me that they ain't falling for this $2,500 bonus nonsense. They want real raises. They want step increases every year to match the cost of living. They also want to have a decent retirement. And this is one of the big attacks that Rick Scott and his allies, including the Speaker of the House, Will Weatherford, and Senate President Don Gates, have tried to do, is they are trying to literally get rid of state pensions altogether and force everyone into what's called a defined contribution plan, where employees are essentially having to put in more money of their own paycheck just to get a semi-okay retirement. The defined benefit plan, which is the pension plan, is what they're trying to get rid of. It's the most secure source of retirement state workers who do not make a whole lot of money get, and they're trying to eliminate that. So while this $2,500 sort of bonus smokescreen is going up, the real act is, of course, behind the curtain, and that is you know, we're trying to get rid of the most stable source of retirement for thousands upon thousands of state workers whose pay bleeds into the local economy and supports local business.
Ray, let me ask you a philosophical question for a second. You know, you're a person who did not grow up in an urban space. You didn't grow up, you know, jaded by the cosmopolitan lights of some big city someplace. You're what I would call a heartland person. You grew up in a small town. What do you think explains this incredible animosity these Republicans seem to have for government workers?
You know, it's hard for me to understand. You know, it's amazing to me how we try and separate out sort of the public sector workers from private sector workers. And it sort of goes back to the ideology that the government doesn't create jobs and so on and so forth. And, you know, most of which is not really true and not economically accurate. The fact of the matter is public workers, you know, help everything else run. And I don't think we really appreciate that. We certainly don't appreciate it in terms of the salaries we give them or the benefits we give them. I think a lot of people are still under the false impression that these folks are, you know, are sort of economic royalists, I guess, you know, sort of above everyone else. But they are not. And considering the line of work they do, they certainly deserve better than what they get. And the other thing that really bothers me too is when the benefits are indeed better, other workers undermine themselves and undermine their communities, by the way, and their families when they say, you know, well, that guy has a pension. I've had this sort of crappy IRA for all these years, you know, and everyone should have a crappy IRA just like me. And that's, of course, not what they say, you know, right up front. But that's what they're implying, is that, you know, but all they're doing is simply perpetuating this race to the bottom for workers. And it's decimating the middle class. Eventually, we as working people have to draw a line and say, look, you know, if you work, if you go to a job every day, which a lot of people do, you know, then you should never have to worry about living in poverty. You should never have to worry about losing your home or losing your health care. Of course, healthcare should not be something you lose. I think that's a whole other issue. Eventually, we've got to stop drawing these artificial lines between working people like public sector and private sector, realize all of this together, and we've got to stop this race to the bottom. We've got to have a standard of good wages, good benefits for everybody. And by the way, as a side note, the key to a lot of that is the right to collectively bargain and to have more of a union presence in Florida, too.
Well, you know, you wonder, is it going to get to the point where they're going to define a company benefit as a suicide catch nets?
I hope not.
We have a healthcare program. They put up a new net.
Right.
But let me ask you this. Now, obviously, the vote is very, very important. It's paramount because clearly they've been playing a lot of games with it. And it's not just in Florida. It's across the country. Do you think the fact that we had such a good turnout can be put at least at some part to the fact that people were made aware of just how many games were being played with the election system?
I think so. I think that's part of it. And certainly we saw one of the reasons why, you know, Floridians take their responsibility to vote very, very seriously. And we saw that because so many of them were willing to wait 8 hours in line to simply cast a ballot. People are dead serious about this stuff. You know, I hope that we can replicate some of that fervor, I should say, in 2014. The fact of the matter is that in 2012, a lot of people were outraged by just the very visible, very extreme right-wing turn of the Republican Party, more so than it had even been before 2008, which I don't think many of us thought was even possible, but they sure know how to, they sure did it. And a lot of folks were really indignant about the idea that these folks were actually trying to take away, their access to the polls. And a lot of folks they reacted, hell no, you're not going to do that, and I will stay here in this line until I get to do what I came here to do. You know, hopefully folks don't quite have to have that level of determination in 2014, but we certainly need that level of enthusiasm again. It's not going to be as easy without President Obama at the top of the ticket either, which we should never underestimate, particularly as a driver of turnout among African Americans, young people, and the Latino community, three communities of which basically would mean that there are, you know, without those three constituencies, the Republican Party would be the left-leaning party in the country. So we need those groups to turn out again, to turn out Rick Scott in particular, first and foremost. But a lot of the folks in the cabinet too. This is something we haven't talked about, but we have some really extreme ideologues in Attorney General Pam Bondi, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, and Chief Financial Officer Jeff Atwater. All these folks are big Rick Scott boosters. To simply remove Rick Scott and not these other folks kind of leaves part of the problem in place. Same goes for the state legislature. We've got a lot of people supporting Rick Scott's anti-middle class agenda in both houses, and we've got to work on removing some of those folks as well, despite gerrymandering and issues with districts, candidate recruitment resources, et cetera. So we've got a lot of work ahead, and I think, you know, one of the big lessons from 2012 is, you know, and I don't think that President Obama necessarily gets a lot of credit for this as well, but President Obama also sort of re-embraced his early progressive roots from 2008 in order to basically get the votes he needed. Now, whether he sticks with that when he governs remains a question to be answered.
It was a lovely speech.
Yes, but the thing is I think, you know, even if President Obama doesn't use those same sort of flourishes in governing, I think it still presents an obvious lesson to the Democratic Party, the progressive movement, people considering running for office, is that's the kind of not only rhetoric but also policy that people want to see.
Are you suggesting there should be a link between rhetoric and policy?
Yes, I really do. Although let me say this too, because I think this is an important point to make as well. In working with Awake the State and in working with sort of this really first major proactive effort by progressives in Florida to actually try and get election reform through, I have begun to appreciate more and more the idea that sometimes the rhetoric doesn't match the policy.
I've noticed that.
Yes, because, you know, that there are a lot of really good, good-hearted folks in our community who want us to do more than simply expand early voting, make ballots reasonably sized, and have portable voter registration. You know, there are a lot of folks, and they're absolutely right, that eventually we want to get to the point where we can have automatic voter registration, where everyone, you know, can essentially has that right to vote.
Well, let me ask you a technical question, if I may. Because you're
a person who
works in, should we say, political technology, right? And you have more than a passing acquaintance with the whole idea of the handshaking of websites and databases and that sort of thing. Now, it seems to me that if we can trust the Internet to do our banking, how much of a stretch is it that we can trust the Internet to do our voting?
It's not a stretch at all. It's something that a lot of other countries in the world have. In fact, there are other states that have online voter registration. There's no reason why the fourth largest, soon to be third largest state in the nation can't do this, period.
One more thing I want to get to, and given the shenanigans that we've seen year after year after year in Tallahassee, as we approach this new term, I'll call it, what do you hear in terms of the next dirty dozen we'll be facing up there with the kind of right-wing legislation that we've seen too often in Tallahassee? Do you have any high points you could point to? Or low points?
I'm sorry, Ricky. I got distracted there. Could you repeat
the question? What I'm basically getting at is we've seen so much incredibly terrible right-wing legislation coming from Tallahassee. Of the ones that you've heard about, can you tick off one or two that strike you as must kills or must stops?
Oh yes, absolutely. The first one that comes to mind is HB 655, which would essentially preempt. It's the big what's called the preemption bill, and in English, what that means is that this is the state trying to tell local governments you cannot pass ordinances like paid sick days or living wage ordinances or anti-wage theft rules, anything relating to sort of that employer-employee relationship that local government cannot do anything about. That, to me, so far is one of the worst pieces to go through. I look at this not only from a policy perspective. Local governments should be able to expand rights and benefits, just like states can expand rights and benefits beyond what the U.S. Constitution refers to, or what federal law refers to. That federalism should extend all the way down to the local level. And certainly Republicans who have been, always allegedly for home rule and local government and local control, this is extremely hypocritical of them to try and preempt local governments from protecting employees and protecting workers and essentially protecting and restoring the middle class. But also from a movement and a political perspective, this is really important as well, because there is not a whole lot of progressive policymaking happening in Tallahassee for obvious reasons. But there are some really good progressive local leaders, as well as policy and ideas happening at the county and city level. And a lot of that has to do with paid sick days and living wage ordinances and anti-wage theft ordinances. And this legislation would snuff a lot of that out. And so for multiple reasons, that needs to go, and as soon as possible. It's a major priority for a lot of different progressive organizations for those reasons. There's also the bill that would eliminate pensions, which I referred to earlier. That would be a huge, huge setback for middle-class families throughout the state. Again, we forget that pensions and retirement benefits, when they're paid out to state employees, get then spent in the local economy. Curtailing those, hurting those, hurts everybody. It's not just public employees. Cannot drive that point home enough. When public employees get hurt, everybody gets hurt, because they are a tremendous, tremendous stimulus to local economies, as are their paychecks. Those two, there's also the parent trigger has returned. This is a really insidious bill by corporate education, quote-unquote, reformers, which I think really does not apply. The term reformer should not apply to these people. But this is a bill that would essentially allow private charter school management companies to take over, quote-unquote, failing public schools if parents vote to do it. This has been a huge disaster in California. We beat it last year. It has come back this year, we need to do everything we can to defeat that. So those are sort of the worst of the worst at this point. I'm sure there'll be more.
Ray, let me ask you to explain a term that is bandied about a lot, but I think a lot of people really don't get what it means. Can you explain what parent trigger means?
Right. So if a school is deemed failing. Public school is deemed failing. I don't think there's any such determination for charter schools. Certainly, and despite the fact that charter schools
are magically better. Dollars.
Yeah, naturally. every study, of course, we have seen, most studies, I should say, that we've seen has demonstrated that charter schools are really no better than public schools in terms of education, achievement, graduation rates, et cetera, et cetera. If public school is deemed failing, which is also under intense debate as to sort of what failing actually means and whether we actually are using the right standards to judge that, which I don't think we are. If a public school is deemed failing, then under the parent trigger bill, if it was law, if a majority of parents vote to change leadership at the school, and I'm not sure if that's the exact term, but if they want, they can vote to change over from a public school to a private charter management company, to turn it into a charter school, essentially. And, of course, the big proponents of this are not parents. The major parent groups in Florida are all opposed to this, from the PTA to local groups like Fund Education Now. Also, the NAACP and LULAC yesterday came out against parent trigger. That this is being promoted by, naturally, as you might expect, follow the money, charter management companies. They want this because, you know, they want to do more business in Florida. And they know that under these really arbitrary, pretty subjective standards that deem certain public schools failing, that they've got a pretty good chance of doing that. All the parent groups in Florida are pretty much against this. And that's what the trigger means. Parents get to pull the trigger against public schools.
Okay. So under the guise of theoretically being responsive to parents, instead of improving the schools, we get to gut the schools, hand them over to a commercial entity who lets us fund their little playground.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I think we can all agree that we want more parent involvement in public schools, and we know that that's one of the major answers to improving student achievement and boosting graduation rates. Having parents more involved in their child's education. Absolutely, I think everybody's in the same boat there. But inserting private charter management companies is not going to do that. And as we've seen with the results with charter schools are really mixed. There's no real proven record that they're somehow better than public schools. There's also the issue of resegregation with charter schools as well, but that's a whole other issue. If this is just my own personal view, if we were really interested in getting more parents involved in their schools, I think our school districts would need to be more engaged than they currently are, at least again from my vantage point. We would actually be devoting resources to supporting school advisory, major resources to supporting school advisory committees, which every school is supposed to have. Our school districts would be sort of having parent academies like what they're doing right now in Hillsborough County, sort of showing parents how they can actually be involved. But also we would do the bigger things too. And this is the thing no politician wants to talk about. A lot of kids are coming to school without proper nutrition. A lot of them are not coming from stable households, some of them. Child poverty is a huge issue in the United States as compared to the rest of the OECD countries. If we were really serious about parental involvement and improving childhood education, we would also be getting serious about poverty, and we're not. We would be doing a lot more with assisting parents in investing in pre-K, which we're really not doing. Even though Florida has a voluntary pre-K program, we've never really invested in it. We would be doing a lot more with child nutrition and helping parents. And healthcare is another huge one. Getting more kids and families enrolled in kid care in Florida. That's really what it means to improve public education is dealing with a lot of the externalities which public schools aren't really on their own are not well equipped to handle.
You know, Ray, you mentioned a term that I'm unfamiliar with because maybe you didn't get the memo. The war on poverty was won some time ago, wasn't it?
I wish. Unfortunately, it's what Dr. King said. The war on poverty has been shot down in the fields of Vietnam. And we unfortunately never got back to it. I don't know if we necessarily need a war on poverty, but we certainly need to be dealing with it.
Well, maybe if the arms merchants could make some dollars on it, maybe it would be worthwhile.
Probably. We need incentives. Yes, lots of incentives.
let me ask you one other question about this parent trigger. Now, isn't it true that a lot of the same companies involved in charter schools are also involved in this, what we might call the testing regime that's being promulgated by Michelle Rhee and her type?
Well, certainly groups like Michelle Rhee's group, which is kind of Orwellian named Students First. Those organizations are certainly pushing a corporate-based agenda of cutthroat competition instead of collaboration. They push for these high stakes tests, which are not good measures of whether students are actually learning or not. They're big on school choice, quote unquote, again, sort of going back to that cutthroat competition and the really insidious merit pay schemes that are developed, and so on and so forth. So yeah, it's sort of the same groups behind a lot of these reforms that, by the way, most public are against. They want to see public schools well funded. They want to see teachers well paid and appreciated. They have no problem with the right to collectively bargain. And, you know, and they also want better programs in schools. They want art and music. They don't want to see schools getting closed down for the sake of budget cuts. So, I mean, again, the public is pretty progressive when it comes to public education, but our elected leaders, like on so many issues, are not.
So as we come down this home stretch, let me ask you to wrap up.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Ray Seaman of Progress Florida with a great interview on the topic of Awake the State, Free the Vote, and a couple other issues. I want to bring on my next guest, Mr. Christian Haas, who's got some wonderful news from the west coast of Florida. Welcome, Christian.
Hey, how's it going?
Real good, real good. Christian, you know, I heard your story when you were talking about the wonderful things being done by Awake Pinellas and the groups there to get the public's agenda actually enacted. First, I want to welcome you and then ask you to tell us a little bit about the Awake Pinellas and what you did to bring together the public to get a public budget instead of the one that was originally designed by the bureaucrats.
Cool, thanks. So my name is Christian, and I organized with a group called Awake Pinellas, and it's an activist group that's a part of the Awake the State Coalition. But what we did was join in collaboration with a whole bunch of other groups. We were just one of probably half a dozen or more groups that started what's called the People's Budget Review. And the People's Budget Review is a grassroots coalition to try and insert the people into the budget process. Because what we saw was a whole bunch of money being spent every year and a whole bunch of city staffers coming together to talk about it, but no public involved. And we actually saw city staff outnumber the public in the few budget hearings that they did have. So we came together with kind of a common conviction that people need to be a part of probably the most important thing a representative democracy does, and that's collect taxes and spend them. So it was a pretty simple idea. It's, you know, if nothing else, at least tell us what you're spending the money on, and if you're open to our ideas, listen to our ideas. So we created an online survey, and we did through, you know, grassroots door knocking and canvassing to going to churches and schools, and we basically allowed the people to see what the city was spending their money on, and we asked them to prioritize what their you know, preferred values are or preferred city expenditures are. And then we put some of the main questions that the city was faced with in front of them, like, do we raise taxes or do we increase fees or do we cut services? And, you know, overwhelmingly, when you give the citizens the choice, what we found was they wanted to preserve the quality of life services that they had, even if it meant taxing themselves a little more.
Well, you know, I was so impressed with that because so many times, you know, we all hear that all politics are local. We hear that, you know, the grassroots starts at the city and the county level. Now, you actually put that into practice. How early, how much ahead of the budget approval process did you actually work with these other groups to start bringing together this public review of the budget?
Right. So we, there are groups like the local NAACP, the League of Women Voters, the Council of Neighborhood Associations, the Sierra Club, Awake Pinellas, obviously, the Service Employees International Union, the Florida Public Service Union. So we had, and I'm sure I'm missing some, but we had a big group of people, and we started meeting and talking around January, and the budget wasn't due to be voted on until August or September. So we had a good half a year to plan, but we really came at it with no direction. We knew that we wanted people to be participating more in the process, but we didn't know what that was going to look like, whether it was going to be just a series of public meetings that we invited people to or if it was going to be a survey, which was the route we ended up doing. But we had probably 5 to 6 months before we maybe a little more, seven, eight months total before the budget was actually passed. But, you know, a lot of us, not I wasn't one of them, but a lot of the people that were involved were, have been tuned into politics. So they knew that the budget was, the cake was pretty much baked probably 3 months before the official vote. But so we knew that we had to act quicker than the timeline the city gave us.
Well, you know, one of the things it reminded me of was that that charming film Dave, where he invites his accountant to come in and look at the federal budget. It seems to me such a challenging prospect from the way most people think about government. Did you have a real conviction that you could adjust the budget, or were you just kind of hoping that things might work out so that the priorities could shift?
Yeah, well, there was a couple. So we all went into it with our own hats and our own kind of positions. But through the conversation, we all realized that in order for this process to work, we have to all first and foremost be committed to our process, and that is that we want the people to have a voice, and we're not trying to hijack the process by any means, but create an avenue through which the people's voice can be either focused or collected or transmitted. We didn't know what it was going to look like, so we didn't really know what we wanted to get out of it. First and foremost, it was education. Obviously, we wanted the people to know what the city was spending money on. And then once we started to see some common themes come out, you know, residents were overwhelmingly opposed to what we called a flat tax as opposed to a more progressive tax. They were opposed to further cuts. So once we started seeing some of these commonalities and the trends, then we started kind of figuring out, well, what can we get behind? Should we come out in support of this, or should we just let the organizations come out in support of it? So we didn't really know if we were going to be taken seriously enough to actually change some of the budget priorities. What we thought from a Wake Pinellas standpoint was, look, we can get some of these people to publicly agree or disagree with what public sentiment is, and if the public overwhelmingly, you know, stands for a position and the city won't stand with them, then we have some fuel come election time. So even if we were totally ignored throughout the budget process, we were kind of hopeful that we could use this process, the People's Budget Review, further on down the road to hold the politicians accountable. But, you know, it turns out we did, through public support and turning out hundreds of people to these budget summits and dozens of speakers, we ended up getting the conservative mayor and largely conservative council to increase taxes in a progressive way. Once they knew that the people wanted them to increase taxes, they came up with this flat tax, which was basically per parcel, per piece of property, it was going to be a flat tax. We rejected that through rounds of surveys and through direct engagement with council members and whatnot. And then they turned out to do what we wanted, which was raise the millage rate, which hadn't been raised in a long time.
Now, just so that I'm clear, because right now, unfortunately, I'm not, because I didn't hear the beginning of your speech at the legislative LegiCamp. Now, was this the county budget or the city budget?
The city of St. Petersburg.
The city of St. Petersburg. Yeah. You know, I, Christian, this is so amazing. This goes back literally to the original democracy idea of the people actually controlling them being the government exactly. I think it's so tremendous, and I hope that there are academics out there studying what you've accomplished. I think it's absolutely laudable.
Yeah, well, thank you, man. And you know, I'm young. I'm 24 years old. I graduated from University of South Florida, St. Pete, studying political science and leadership. And one of the questions that I left school with was, why are we so heavily a representative democracy locally? It makes sense when, you know, back in the 17, 1800s when we needed, you know, a couple weeks to transfer messages to the federal government. I understand logistically why we need to separate the people from the power, but when it's our community and our schools and our rec centers and our own public employees and our own sanitation workers, I feel like at the very least the citizens should be tuned into that. Democracy, I'm convinced, isn't all about tuning in every 4 years to vote or considering yourself a super voter if you tune in every 2 years. I think it's much more than that. I think you need to keep a pulse on what's going on. You need to be fundamentally committed to the concept that we are all connected and our fates are connected, and And if you're letting, you know, somebody manage you and all of your neighbors' money without paying attention, then there's something wrong there. And I think if more people felt like they had more influence over the process, their efficacy was increased. If we could create some sort of avenue or tool for them to use to engage their government, I truly believe that we will. I think more people will be concerned with politics and won't consider it just, you know, something for a certain type of people to talk about. Politics should be, especially local politics, that should be the very first thing we talk about at the dinner table, not the last thing. So, you know, I think that's, so a lot of people are tuning in. We can almost put a dollar amount to the per voter. If we can get more people engaged in the city budget, we can literally say, look, you know, this group of people is responsible for this many million dollars going to this, or this many million dollars going to this program. So I think that's a motivating factor. And I think once we can streamline this and maybe institutionalize it, I'm thinking we can get more people locally involved.
Well, you know, that's exactly my next question. Did you get a commitment from the elected officials that this is going to be the standard way the process occurs?
No. I think they went, once they saw the process take off and all the support we had, I think they kind of jumped in front of it and said, this is a great thing for St. Petersburg. But at first, they were real skeptical. I mean, what we're really taking some allocation authority away from them, whereas it used to be solely their decision. Now they got to, you know, factor in the people's opinions, and they weren't used to that. So we did get, you know, I was kind of hesitant to embrace, and everybody was hesitant to embrace the elected officials. But you know, we need information from them, and if they want to work collaboratively, let's do it. I think that's great. Mayor Foster gave us some kudos. He said it was one of the most democratic processes in the history of St. Petersburg. But other than that, I think what we did for him was give him a little political cover, because his base probably wasn't happy with the millage rate increase. But if he says, look, man, you guys weren't out there organizing, you know, hopefully this process and this idea can get people of all spectrums to come out and organize and to realize that, look, if you just get people to sit down in front of your elected local officials, you can change their mind.
I think it's so impressive. Did you guys create a series of documents about this process? Is there a website that details how this evolved?
Yeah, sure. You can download all the old surveys at peoplesbudgetreview.org. You can check out some of the results, some of the questions. One of the hardest things, because we had a diverse array of people participating, was coming up with the questions, making sure they weren't leading, making sure they were relevant, and they involved decisions that were, you know, currently being discussed. So we came out with three different surveys. We launched them in three different phases, and they all built off of each other. The first one was more broad, a framework of what the overall budget looks like. And then the next two were detailing the questions that were in front of the city, like how can we increase efficiency, and how can we raise enough revenue, or should we raise enough revenue? So the surveys got more specific as they went on, as the conversation developed. And you can check that out at www.peoplesbudgetreview.org, or you can look on Facebook, facebook.com/peoplesbudgetreview.
Wow, that is tremendous, Christian. I just can't tell you how impressed I am that you guys were able to pull that off. And I hope that there are other Floridians listening that are going to undertake the same thing. Thank you so much for joining us. And I'd love to see you come back again. Are you guys, are you going to try to do the same process this year?
Oh, yeah. The overall goal is to kind of get this process institutionalized, so we can, you know, where the people expect it. You know, it becomes a part of the citizen culture in St. Pete, where not only do we go and vote, but we go and hold our representatives accountable to what they're about to spend all our money on, too. So that's the goal. We're going to come back every year. And this year we're in a weird spot, because we know the people aren't going to be that interested with the budget, because we got a big city council race, a mayor's race. People are heated about, you know, some local issues. So we're in an interesting period of, you know, realizing that we need to adapt to the popular energy, because we know the mayor's race is going to suck a lot of the energy. What we think we can do is maybe instead of having the politicians focus on their favorite issues like the Tampa Bay Rays or the new pier that they want to build, we're hoping we can maybe make the election more about the budget. So that's kind of the angle we're going to take, is rekindle some of the old budget issues that the politicians don't like to talk about during the election, and we'll see how that goes.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Christian. Please come back again, okay?
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for the opportunity. I'll be back anytime.
Okay, buddy. Thanks again. Bye-bye.
Have a good one.
That was Christian Haas of Awake Pinellas with a tremendous story about how the people took hold of their own budget and made the politicians listen. Because after all, let's not forget these civil servants work for us. Fantastic story. Just really powerful stuff. This can be done. It is your government. It is your budget. You can control it. I want to thank also all our good supporting colleagues and progressive journalists, Susan Nylon with her Nylon Report, Gwendolyn Holden-Berry with her Here Be Monster show, our good friend Anita Stewart on her show, Brian Stetton with his Progress Toward Democracy, and of course our friend from across the water, Dennis Campbell, with his Worldview show on YouTube. So make sure you check those out. Now our final guest of the evening, I'm going to bring on Flash, who's going to talk about the upcoming Saturday, the 2nd of March, medical marijuana benefit in Miami at the famous oldest bar in Miami, Tobacco Road. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome Mr. Flash, who is a man of many hats, a talented artist of many pursuits, a producer, and an advocate for human liberty and freedom. I understand, Mr. Flash, that you are producing this next annual medical marijuana benefit. Why don't you tell us about it?
Yes, we are working on the 15th annual medical marijuana benefit concert. This will be happening on Tobacco Road Saturday, March 2nd. Saturday, March 2nd, very soon. And we have a great show starting at 6 in the evening, going till 3 in the morning. Three stages, 90 different acts, all sorts of music, speakers, poets, dancers, fire performers, jugglers. We'll have information booths, and it will be a time to remember. So we're looking forward to bringing everyone together to celebrate the virtues of medical marijuana and being able to promote liberty and freedom.
You know, Flash, I was going to mention something. It's a wonderful event that you put on. I've had the good fortune to participate in many of those. And you bring together such a wonderful cast of characters. You've got all this talent, musicians and fabric artists. You've got poets. You've got multimedia artists. You've got presentations, lectures, wonderful arts and crafts there. Everything from T-shirts to massage, a whole variety of things. I got to ask you this. It seems that there are states in this wonderful United States where they've actually legalized marijuana, whether it be medical or recreational, and civilization has not collapsed. Do you think it would be possible sometime in some future more sane Florida that Florida might also come to the conclusion that it's really stupid to waste the state's money locking people up because they want to alter their brain chemistry?
Amid stupidity, that is a feat not government like. I would like to think that we as citizens can evolve and laws can change when people get together and focus on them, which is what's happened in all these other states. Right now there are 18 states plus Washington, D.C. that have legalized medical marijuana. Some of them have actually been done legislatively. Most of them have been done through citizen initiative and referendum. And people start working on small things, city districts, municipalities, and bit by bit it grows. And year after year, we keep updating the press release with bigger numbers. Last year, it was 16. Now we're up to 18. And it's just wonderful to see all these things happening. And it's really just a testament to people getting involved. A lot of times people will always ask me, when will it happen here? And my basic response is when more people get involved. Politics is not a passive occupation of sorts. You know, this is requiring active people to get together and support each other. You know, I don't expect a lot of people to do a lot of the work like what I do as far as organizing and producing and street campaigning and all that sort of stuff. But I think there are ways for other people to get involved and vocalize and contribute. And that's really what I'm looking for with this event. And also just to show the sense of solidarity where we are bringing in elected officials like Florida State Senator Dwight Bullard, Florida House Rep Katie Edwards, South Miami City Commissioner Walter Harris. We also even have Senior Circuit Court Judge Rick Margolis. So there are people that are stepping up and involved. And there is legislation in process for the second time in 30 years here in Florida. So what we're working for is really just to turn things on and show that the support is there. You know, I honestly believe that the majority of people believe that medical marijuana, as well as recreational marijuana, should be legal. Most people believe that they shouldn't go to jail for a joint, especially if you're sick. If you're dealing with cancer or AIDS or multiple sclerosis or rheumatoid arthritis or glaucoma or any number of serious ailments, and you find that marijuana helps relieve the symptoms and is, you know, beneficial to your own well-being, you shouldn't go to jail. And these are basic human rights and basic things that people should recognize as someone living in a so-called free society to do. You know, no one's ever died from a marijuana overdose. And you can't say that about most of the pharmaceuticals that are being prescribed, as well as other legal substances like alcohol or cigarettes. And we're not looking for saying, okay, now we're going to add marijuana to the list. It's more like, how about we regulate a substance that is already there and take it out of the hands of criminals and put it into a licensed system. You know, people have been able to regulate alcohol and tobacco much better. You can't buy alcohol if you're under 21 legally, and drug dealers don't card people. So this would be taking the marijuana out of the hands of children in some ways, making it a little more difficult. And for those people who are law-abiding, they will be able to partake and not risk all the dangers of marijuana prohibition, which is more dangerous than the substance itself. You know, more people have been killed by the drug war than by the drug itself. And it's really important to recognize that we do have an alternative to mass incarceration. We have more people in jail than any country in the world, largely because of the drug war. We have federal mandatory minimums where people are in jail for marijuana longer than murder and rape. And we as a society have to realize that we have some control over this, and we're paying for it. We are putting billions of dollars into incarceration, which could easily be turned into education, so people don't have to have this system the way it is. And we have to stand up and realize that there is a possibility that there is an alternative when we just say no. You know, we say no to the drug war, no to the mass arrest, no to the oversight of police rather than doctors. You know, I'd rather have the politicians realize that medical marijuana in itself should be handled by doctors. You know, that's the thing. When a doctor prescribes marijuana to a patient, they're putting their license, their integrity as a professional, and their livelihood at stake because they believe in it. And right now, doctors can't even talk about it legally. And this is a backward system. It's been built over the last 70 plus years, and it's going to take a little bit to adjust it to something sane, but it needs to happen. We work with organizations like Students for Sensible Drug Policy, and that's the next generation of young people stepping up for education and awareness, and we need to be able to address these issues in a more rational way. And I think it's time that we do it, and that's why on Saturday, March 2nd at Tobacco Road, we're encouraging people to come together and support the cause.
How much are tickets, Flash?
They are $10 in advance if people go to ploppypalace.com and they can buy them online through PayPal, or $12 at the door.
That's a tremendously reasonable amount for all that entertainment. My goodness.
Education with over 30 acts, and largely because the performers and many of the people involved are donating their time and the talent for the cause. If we had to pay for this type of show and pay for all the performers at their real worth, it certainly would not be a $12 show, because we have such a great amount of talent and so many people that, you know, when they are getting paid for their, you know, their creative energy and skills, they are able to charge a lot more. But because they are donating for this cause, you know, we're able to keep the price low. We want to make it so a lot of people show up, and we've been working with Tobacco Road to organize with things like parking and build up the promotions, and they've been really great for support for this event. So I encourage everyone to come out and join us at Tobacco Road, because it is such a wonderful historic place.
And this is this the 11th annual or 12th?
No, we're at the 15th. We've been doing
15 years. That's fantastic.
And to me, this is so interesting, because I honestly hope we don't make it to the 21st anniversary of it, where people were born when we started this show and we're still fighting for it. But we will continue fighting, because we need to. You know, this requires the endurance of a lot of people to make things happen, and I'm always motivated by the people that come together, and you know, we're working it, and bit by bit things get done. More people get involved each year. We keep working on building up our email list, and a really good way to stay in touch is through Facebook right now. And people can find me at Ploppy Palace on Facebook, and I'm looking to connect with local South Florida supporters. They can also look up South Florida MJ Activists on Facebook as well. Networking is a key component to this. You know, we have to find ways to organize. There's also a GoFundMe page, because we are looking to find people that can contribute. And if they go to the Facebook event for the 15th Annual Medical Marijuana Benefit Concert, they will see a way that people could donate to the show. And I also would like to encourage people that even if they can't physically make it to the event, you know, there's many people that always say, well, I'm there with you in spirit. Well, spirit is wonderful, but buy a ticket. You know, it costs $10. It's less than a meal. If for those people that do smoke, consider it a support cause for the cause. You know, $10 for supporting the cause, even if you can't make it, makes a difference for what we have to do, because even though the performers are not charging their normal rates, there are still a number of expenses to put on a production like this. So every little bit helps. $10 donations, $20, $100, you know, every little bit works to go to the cause, because once we cover the expenses of it, we're putting it towards public education and lobbying. We are working with people up in Tallahassee to be able to educate and, you know, show that this is a real issue. And unless the politicians believe that we're out there doing this, they will ignore it as, well, I don't have to stick my neck out for this cause because the people don't believe it strong enough. And that is a big misnomer, because there is a disconnect between the elected officials and the public at large. And that's one of the reasons we do events like this, is to show the solidarity. When we bring in thousands of people and we show that the support, and people are signing petitions and writing letters and being active on that level, it makes a statement. And when we're able to present it to officials and people who are working within the system, that's a strong message. And we are always looking to try and find ways to network with more organizations. We have working with the ACLU of Greater Miami, the Florida Green Party, I'm a Patient Not a Criminal, the Silver Tour, Normal Florida, Puffem, and there's just people that are out there working together. And when we do all these things, you know, stuff gets done. And that's really what we're working towards, because there is a sense of solidarity that we're able to initiate through these type of events. And I'm encouraged, and I would like to encourage other people to get involved. You know, more, we have the numbers on our side, and it's just a matter of showing it. I honestly believe that most people, when asked, would say they don't believe that someone should go to jail for a joint. And I would certainly say, if someone's dealing with serious medical issues and they're using it to treat it and they're working with their doctor, they should be left alone. And someone dealing with cancer or AIDS or multiple sclerosis or any number of serious ailments, if they're a law-abiding citizen, they should be left as a law-abiding citizen and not be treated as a criminal.
Well, besides the fact that it sounds like, to me, it's well under the heading of pursuit of happiness, the other thing is, I think the only force that's working against freedom for marijuana is the prison complex, the prison industries. And they always like to stack their warehouses with lots of humans and waste an awful lot of resources so they can make a buck. I want to thank you, Flash, and I want you to know that the listeners we have across the state of Florida in over 47 cities, they are going to help and support this. Many of you out there know that this is something that should not be penalized, it should not be criminalized. Please, if you can, support the good people of the Medical Marijuana Benefit. Flash, why don't you tell them that website one more time and your Facebook site?
Yes, it's ploppypalace.com. ploppypalace.com. If you find it on Facebook, it's the one-eyed smiley face, so it's really easy to spot. And go to facebook.com/ploppypalace. You can find it there, or go to facebook.com/South Florida MJ Activist, and you can find more information there. I've been posting different things under the event page of the 15th Annual Medical Marijuana Benefit Concert, different little factoids and tidbits and ways to try and motivate people and build up conversations and keep communication going. And it's been a wonderful adventure. And we look forward to building it and strengthening it. And we have a great show for people that can't attend. And again, for those who can't, check out the GoFundMe site as well, which is listed on the Facebook event. So, you know, the more people that get involved, the more things get done. And I always appreciate your support, Rick.
Thank you, brother, and congratulations again for another wonderful project. Best of luck, and we'll see you there.
Very good, thank you.
Bye-bye. Well, thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us for another Progressive News Network show. We've had some wonderful guests tonight, and next week we've got even more. Next week is going to be our Violence Against Women show. It's the in support of all those great women out there that make this a better world for us. And I want you to know that we've got, in addition to the good people from Planned Parenthood, Lisa Morano is going to join us. Meredith Ackman is going to join us. And Sita Bajul is going to join us. And our good friend Maureen
will be joining us from the Democratic Women's Club. So hope you all tune in next week for our Violence Against Women Act show, and there'll be more to come. Thanks again, Rick Spezak, News Director, Progressive News Network. Thanks again. Tune in next week, and if you can, support us any way you can. Spread the word. Thanks again. Rick Spezak, have a good night.
Fly specks. I've been spending my life among fly specks while miracles have been leaning on lampposts at 18th and Fairfax.
Thanks for being there, folks. Have a good night.